Why? We're going to take this. Can we please take our seat? Let's take more presentation, then we'll talk about growth and acquisition. And venture capital later on. You'll introduce yourself and the organization you represent.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Chair. Thanks, members, for making the time for us to come and speak. We're from a company called Bravura, which is a combined investment banking corporate finance advisory company. We supply services to various of the corporates in the market. My name is James Aitchison. To my left is Stefan van der Walt, who's the head of our corporate finance team. We're just going to go through certain selected highlights, a number of which I'm sure you've no doubt heard on numerous occasions. We'll make some opening remarks, and then the key focus of the presentation, which my colleague will deal with, is on the 45, the 8E, and the 8E cap A. One comment that I would make at the outset with regard to 45, so, and again, in line with other comments that you've heard, there's no doubt that it's absolutely within Treasury's right and the fiscus's right to make these amendments. Whether it's wise to do so is a different discussion, but the point that we want to make here is not the removal, it's the manner in which the removal has been done on an unwarned basis, and the dangers that that can bring from an investor confidence perspective and from a political risk perspective. In the detailed pack that we've provided, you'll see Australia did something similar in 2010 with regard to their mining super tax. And there was a large outcry and the risk attributed to that from a sovereign risk and the increased debt exposure. The second point that we would like to make is also linked to the Section 45. You've heard much about its dangers in the context of a leveraged buyout style transaction. Now, to put that in context, that's not an issue in other jurisdictions because of the protection of taxpayers through a number of other methodologies, such as group taxation, whether that is on the basis of consolidated tax returns or loss surrender between entities, doesn't really make a difference, and also interest deductibility on the shares. I think we'll cover that more in more detail when we go through this presentation in Section 45. And it's important to remember here, South Africa has a large number of fiscal protection mechanisms, such as the GAR, FinCap, transfer pricing, controlled foreign companies, but we're not on a competitive basis with a number of other jurisdictions as to some what are seen as basic protections in other jurisdictions. I think just to touch briefly, before we go on to the need for equity, on the timeframes and process to address a couple of points that were made, I heard just before we came on, the chair mentioning to the other parties that yes, there are a number of parties sitting presenting to you here are professional bodies. The reality here is there were some 376 pages between the bills and the explanatory memoranda published on the evening of the 2nd of June for comment. That then gives 11 working days before the presentations to this committee. Now for us, 11 working days is obviously a relatively short period of time. For the committee members, you're not only dealing with the 376 pages, there are also the presentations from ourselves and from all the other parties. So I would have of the pages before you are in excess of 1,000 pages. So the other point that I would make there as well is in terms of 11 working days for us to assume and comment on all these documents, the reality is National Treasury and SARS have been working on the documents that you see since October last year. So they've had 6 to 8 months to put together this, and we're given 11 days to comment. So I think just please bear that in mind. The 4th of July represents a month of a comment period, and I would suggest that a month of comment period is probably a fairer opportunity for us to comment before we come before the committee. See, the other point that I just want to make in terms of much has been made of by Treasury this time, in particular in the context of avoidance of the net plus, the net minus, and the need for neutrality in the system. And I think that's very good. And it's obviously the basis on which a number of these things would never give rise to any issue. So seeking neutrality, understood, perfectly equitable. And you see in the bill itself a number of instances where that concept is actually sought this year. The concept of perpetual debt treats something as non-deductible on one side, non-taxable on the other. Contingent liabilities ensures a single deduction and non-taxation. The insurance benefits, I get a deduction of the company if it's a tax benefit in the employee's hands. All of that aimed at neutrality, very good. Similarly, our general anti-avoidance rule is aimed at neutrality. If SARs make an alteration to one taxpayer in a transaction, the legislation obliges them to make a comparable adjustment in the other taxpayer. So that I think is great, and that's where a tax system should be going. The Lloyd mentioned yesterday, yes, there's no equity in tax. That doesn't mean it's not something that we should actually strive for in the system. There will always be exceptions. I think the one mentioned last year was bond interest, where as an individual, you don't get a tax deduction for the interest you pay to the bank on your bond, but the bank is nonetheless taxed on it. And I think that's a key example where that's absolutely fair, because it actually represents personal consumption. You shouldn't be given a tax break for personal consumption. However, our concern here is there are a large number of instances in the tax legislation where there is non-neutrality, and it's legislated non-neutrality very much in the favour of the fisc. And we've listed a couple of them there where, in a number of instances, dividends are treated as dividends in the payor's hands, being non-deductible and subject to either the secondary tax on companies or, going forward, the withholding tax on dividends, but they're treated as taxable income in the other hands. That would be the case in terms of certain employee share schemes, where it's treated as hidden salary, so therefore taxed in the employee's hands, but no deduction on the other side, or short-term funding mechanisms. Preference shares with a term of less than 3 years are non-deductible but yet taxable on the other hand. Section 42, we've heard much on Section 45. Section 42 is an alternative relief, but the downside to Section 42 is it actually doubles up CGT exposure within the tax net. So I think the one thing we would say here is what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If SARS is arguing, Treasury are arguing, that we're seeking neutrality in the system from a taxpayer side, then it has to be a balanced card. It has to be in both sides of the equation. I'll turn over now to my colleague on the Section 45 aspect.
Thank you, James. I would just like to speak a bit about more non-tax terms, but more from a commercial point of view, the impact of Section 45, the proposed amendments to Section 45, 8E and 8EA. Now, just before I start, I just want to revisit again why Treasury has explained the need for the changes. And I quote, intergroup relief is used to disguise indirect purchases of preference shares generating tax-free dividends. And on the other hand, a number of transactions have been identified involving the use of share issues to disguise otherwise taxable interest as tax-free dividend income. Now, whilst that may be the case in a very limited number of instances, in by far the majority of instances, this will have far-reaching consequences on very innocent transactions. And I'll try to take the committee and those present through some of those instances to illustrate what those far-reaching consequences may be. Okay, so what I want to talk about is basically in two scenarios. The first one is obviously BEE transactions, which you have heard about as well. And the second one is on the impact these changes will have on M&A activity and the negative impact that would be. Firstly, I think with empowerment, we've come a long way in terms of trying to develop sustainable forms of BEE funding. And the model whereby a newco is established and the business is sold into that newco on loan account has now proven to be the only form of sustainable BEE ownership funding. Through the global financial crisis, the transactions which have been designed around this concept has not been under pressure, they have not been underwater, compared to the only alternative model, which is the SPV model, where the BEE parties basically fund themselves with debt. And those models have illustrated themselves to be highly unsustainable and highly costly to corporates. Now, this leverage model, where Section 45 is obviously utilized, is also then very much in line with what both the Department of Minerals want, as well as the DTI, in the sense that both of those scorecards actually try to force companies to do transactions where the BEE parties don't incur debts on their balance sheets, but that the company actually incur the debt and that the BEE parties basically invest at a nominal amount. Now, the removal of Section 45 will basically take the ability to do that away, and that obviously contradicts what those two government departments also want. What's further then the case is if Section 45 is removed, basically your only alternative, as I said, is basically now to do SPV funding, so where the BEE parties raise funding to acquire shares. That's always done in the form of preference shares, or almost always. With the proposed changes with Section 8E and Section 8E as well, those transactions, which is now the only viable alternative, will now also be very negatively impacted, in the sense that the BEE parties may be actually subject to tax three times, and I'll try to illustrate that later in the presentation as well. Should Section 8E and Section 8EA go through, the impact of that is essentially that the funding for BEE transactions will increase by about 40%. Now, if you look at an environment where transactions are already very unsustainable, an additional increase in 40% of the funding cost will basically mean that there's no real value in empowerment, and companies may just as well just leave it alone. And then further, I think the amendments in terms of Section 8EA is so far-reaching that the BEE parties will not just be subject to tax when on the funding side of the transaction, but also in respect of the ordinary shares which they actually hold, because those shares will typically be subject to preemptive rights, which Section 8EA will also now actually capture. So dividends received by BEE parties in those transactions will actually also now be subject to Income Tax Act. So essentially, if you look at it, the BEE parties are being taxed three times. So they're taxed in the company where the profits are being generated, they're taxed when they receive the dividend from the company on their ordinary shares, and then the funder is taxed again on the dividend, and they will require a gross up from the BEE party. So the only real party standing to lose here would be the BEE participants in BEE schemes. Then in respect of M&A transactions, Section 45 is a key tool in trying to bring buyers and sellers together, because sellers always want to sell the shares, buyers always want to buy assets. Section 45 is probably the only viable tool in actually meeting that. So if you take that away, you basically take away the ability of many transactions to actually be concluded. Secondly, the removal of 45 is obviously very key, as well as the proposed amendments to Section 8E in terms of the ability to introduce gearing into transactions. Now, the lack of gearing essentially results in a higher cost of funding. If there's a higher cost of funding, obviously less transactions would be concluded. And the impact of that is that companies won't be able to grow their assets, leading to a loss of economic growth, loss of job creation, and that, especially in these days, is not where we actually want to go to. Okay, so quickly just on BEE transactions, I've briefly explained the model. So what Section 45 is now doing, as I've said, is it is forcing companies to move away from the leveraged model, where the business is sold on loan account to a new company and BEE parties are introduced at a nominal value, to a model where the BEE parties need to incur debts on their own balance sheet. Now, I've listed just some of the key disadvantages of this SPV model and why it doesn't work. Firstly, if you go back to Finance 101, the key principle is you don't buy shares using debt. The BSPV model being the only alternative now will force companies to basically do this, which is a very unsustainable model because it's share price dependent. As a result, these transactions typically result in much less shares actually going to the BEE parties at the end of the term. We've seen typically in the market, if you do a 20% transaction, you're likely that only 2 to 5% of the shares will actually go to BEE participants using this model, compared to the leverage model, where the BEE parties will always end up with 25% of the transaction if that was the initial stake. Secondly, the use of preference share funding is always in the medium term, so it's 5 to 7 years. It's almost impossible for companies to repay those preference shares in 5 to 7 years. If we don't have Section 45, again, we need to be forced into this unsustainable form of funding. The next point is that when doing SPV funding, typically external funders will require up to 70% of the equity to be contributed by the BEE parties. That has changed from pre the credit crisis, where it was about 30%. So it is extremely problematic to bring in broad-based parties, which is, again, policy of the DTI and also the Department of Minerals, because those parties obviously don't have money. So it becomes extremely difficult to actually do broad-based transactions using the SPV model. The last point I just want to touch on is that the SPV model has a significant impact on the day-to-day operations of companies. If a company needs to pay out dividends instead of using that cash in the company to actually grow its business so that it can fund its BEE transaction, then obviously that has a significant impact on the future growth of that company. Now again, we need Section 45 to actually do the leverage type of BEE transaction so that one do have a sustainable form of empowerment going forward. Okay, just on the next slide, I just quickly want to illustrate, you know, why in the majority of cases there's no leakage to the fiscus and there's total tax neutrality. Now in the leverage model, essentially what will happen is the new company who incurred the debt will actually get a tax deduction. The funder would typically be taxed on the interest received. So the BEE party will then also receive dividends, and those dividends will be subject to an STC credit. So from the fiscus perspective, they've received their tax in respect of the interest received from the funder. Should the proposed legislation go through, then obviously there would be no rollover relief when Section 45 is done. So without any economic realization or value, capital gains tax is then triggered. Essentially, it will result in no debt being introduced into transactions at all. And with previously concluded transactions based on this basis, the BEE parties will also now be subject to tax on the ordinary dividends they receive, because they will typically be the subject of a shareholders agreement, which will have preemptive rights. So again, those shares falling right into 8E. So there's a lot of additional tax being posed onto the BEE parties. In terms of the SPV model, obviously the profits are being taxed in the company itself. Then a dividend is declared. There's no deduction in the company for the dividend being declared. The BEE participants don't receive, is not taxed on the dividends that they actually receive. So again, there's tax neutrality in the system. The profits have been taxed once. Should the proposed amendments go through, as I've indicated before, the funders will now be subject to tax on the preference dividend received. They will require a gross up from the BEE parties. And based on, again, the shareholders' agreements, the BEE parties will be subject to tax on the ordinary dividends. So again, just illustrating that there's now tax being charged three times on the same profits. So just my point there at the end, so while there are some bad transactions that have been implemented, those transactions should probably be targeted with targeted legislation or in terms of GAR, as the proposed amendments will actually mean the end of BEE transactions in South Africa. I can't see how advisors can advise companies to complete a transaction where there's any real expectation to generating value to the BEE parties if these changes actually go through. Okay, just on the next slide, I just want to illustrate quickly what this impact actually means. If you have a BEE transaction having been completed with the SPV model and your funding rate on the preference shares are currently 12%, what Section 8E and Section 8EA will now do is that those dividends, of course, would be subject to tax in the hands of the funder. They will require a gross up, so for the BEE parties, the funding cost actually increased from 12% to 17%. The impact of that is that over a 10-year term, the value of the shares need to increase from 209% to 315%. Compared to 315% before any value is created for the BEE parties. For the full portion to actually vest, you need a 700% increase in equity values over 10 years as a result of these amendments. And that's all just because of the tax leakages going out as part of this transaction, which obviously illustrates that it's highly unsustainable. Okay, so what we've also done is we've, since the bill has been announced, we actually looked at a number of announced BEE transactions, and we looked at their terms, and we looked at, and we said, how would they actually be impacted by this legislation? Firstly, Avenge. They have preference shares coming shorter than 8 years. They're also having better security mechanisms, both falling under 8E and 8EA, most likely result in double or triple tax for the BEE parties. African Bank, they have preference shares shorter or longer than 10 years for their implemented BEE transaction. They're subject to double tax. Altec, they've announced a transaction using Section 45. As far as we know, they haven't implemented all those transactions as yet, so just like PMC, they will struggle to actually implement the remainder of their transaction. PMC obviously made a presentation yesterday. MTN transaction also have preference shares shorter than 10 years and also embedded security mechanisms, so those parties again would be subject to tax most likely three times. And then the SAFO and Zalo scheme, which everyone has been so, has been in the paper so much and has been worth a large success at that point in time. The BEE vehicle who actually borrowed the money and whose shares are listed for the black public will actually now also face the same type of tax consequences and most likely be subject to tax three times. Okay, so that's BEE transactions. Then just in general on normal mergers and acquisitions. Now, acquisitions can only happen if the profits or returns that companies will generate will exceed the cost of funding. Now, cost of funding is basically a combination of the cost of equity and the cost of debt. Debt typically is much cheaper than equity. So if you remove debt from your ability to raise funding, the impact is that your cost of funding will actually increase. And that would reduce the feasibility of many projects and companies being able to work their assets to grow their economy. Okay, so as I said, for acquisitions to succeed, you need efficient funding is absolutely essential. Now, in our view, tax policy should promote economic growth and new jobs. That, of course, will have a long-term positive impact on the fiscus as well. Tax policy, which results in a material increase in the cost of funding due to double taxation, should be avoided at all costs. Now, there's been a lot being said about preference shares and redeemable preference shares, but preference shares is a fundamental financing tool in the finance world to fill in the gap between equity and debt, and it's used in many instances. And if you look at preference shares, they, even though there may be some characteristics looking like debt, it's absolutely not debt at the end of the day. Now, the abolishment of Section 45 leaves redeemable preference shares as the only other form of term funding that companies can use when they make acquisitions. However, due to Section 8E and Section 8EA and the amendments proposed, the funding for redeemable preference shares will now actually go up by as much as 40%. Obviously, this will result in many transactions now not being feasible going forward. I think this is also obviously made worse by the fact that, unlike the most modern tax jurisdictions, we don't have the ability in South Africa to get a deduction for interest when we buy shares. Now, where this is especially important is Section 45, as I've said before, is then very much used to bring buyers and sellers together. So if we can't now use 45 and bring in normal debt, we also can't use preference shares. The only viable alternative is then a pure form of equity, which will make transactions very, very difficult to actually conclude. Now, again, what I just want to illustrate is tax neutrality in the system. Now, if a transaction is being concluded and funded with preference shares, again, the company buying the shares will actually generate the profit. Profits will actually be taxed in the company. The company paying the preference share dividend won't get a deduction for the dividend being paid, and the recipient will obviously not be taxed on that dividend. With the proposed amendments, however, there would be an additional tax where the profits on the preference shares the dividends on the preference shares will now also be taxed in the hands of the funder, again leading to double taxation and an increase in funding costs. Lastly, if the transaction is funded with normal interest-bearing loans, the company will get a deduction, And again, in general, the interest would be taxed in the hands of the funder. Now, there may be very limited instances and some instances where that's not the case, but in the majority of instances, this will actually be the position. So the point ultimately is that all of these changes lead to double taxation and an increase of cost of funding, leading to an increased cost of doing business in South Africa, making South Africa even less a competitive environment to do business in. This is obviously not conducive to economic growth and job creation. Then just quickly, some other far-reaching impacts. I've mentioned it in the context of BEE transactions. But Section 8EA has been drafted extremely broad. Now, the purpose is obviously to target transactions which are akin to debt. But the way that it has been drafted, it will also basically impact on transactions where there's preemptive rights over any ordinary share. So the impact of that is that if a company holds an ordinary share yielding a normal dividend, and that company is subject to a preemptive right, which basically all shareholders' agreements will actually have in, the dividends on those shares will now become taxable, which obviously, again, doesn't make sense given the fact that the profits have been taxed in the company already. Okay, so just to conclude, the proposed amendments are obviously aimed at targeting transactions that disguise the nature of income earned. The proposed amendments, however, impact very negatively on the majority of transactions, which are also innocent. In our view, the existing legislation, through the anti-avoidance provisions that's already in place, should provide the ability to address the intended mischief. And if it is still required that additional changes be made, that those changes are made very targeted and are also addressed to where the actual mischief takes place and not at the corporate level where innocent transactions are being concluded.
Thank you. I'd like to just close with one final comment to address something that was said to the committee earlier today. The concept was put forward that local debt, where the local bank is taxed on interest, good. Foreign debt, bad, because the foreign debt is not subject to tax. Well, that's a very specific policy decision. I mean, it's going to change going forward because obviously foreign debt is now going to be subject to the withholding tax on interest from January 2013. But the reality is foreign debt is something that South Africa still needs. And if you were to say, okay, how do we make foreign debt equivalent? We tax the foreign debt. The reality, again, similar to the ATE story, the foreign bank will simply gross up and financing will become more expensive for South Africa. The concern, I would suggest, is not foreign debt per se. Foreign debt per se is not bad. The issue seems to be where foreign debt goes off and then there is, in addition to that, an exempt return coming into South Africa off the back of that. Where a South African entity borrows from a foreign bank, yes, there is a funding cost going off offshore, which is not taxed. But then we need to look at the other side of the equation and say, that results in cash coming into South Africa. That cash, provided it is being put to use in South Africa, the intention is that the cash will generate a return in excess of the funding cost. Otherwise, you wouldn't be borrowing. The intention is to earn a profit. Which profit would be subject to tax in South Africa? So I just want to caution against seeing foreign debt per se as being bad. It's not, and it's something that is essential to the South African economy just now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. We'll take the next presentation by South African Venture Capital. Are you here? Venture Capitalist.
Linda.
And Private Equity Association. Take your time and set your gadgets.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it's SAFCA, which is the Southern African Venture Capital and Private Equity Association. My name is JP Faree. I'm the CEO there. SAFCA is a non-profit industry association that represents the interests of the venture capital and private equity industry in South Africa. We've got 77 full members and some 35 associate members. Those full members manage just on 100 billion rands worth of assets. Our objectives today are to give you a brief overview of our industry, discuss very briefly some of the facts and figures of our industry and the economic impact thereof, and then discuss the impact specifically on the suspension of Section 45, where I'll hand over to Mark. It is also important to note that recently there have been three big changes from a regulatory point of view that have promoted or fostered the development of private equity in South Africa. One would be the Pension Funds Control Act, where Regulation 28 has now been relaxed so that pension funds can invest more assets from the 2.5% previously. As at 1 July of this year, pension funds will be able to invest up to 10% of their assets into private equity funds. Obviously, the permanent tax establishment rules that were changed at the beginning of this year, and then some exchange control dispensations which allow private equity fund managers to more easily execute transactions outside of South Africa's borders. From the presentation, you'll see that private equity is good for our economy and good for the expansion of businesses. Just very briefly, in terms of what is private equity is typically transformational in nature, where a private equity fund will raise funds from an investor or a group of investors, be they development finance institutions, insurance companies, banks, etc. And they would invest that money with a specific endpoint in mind. So the fund's normal duration or life cycle is 10 years, 5 years to invest the funds, 5 years to harvest the investments that have been made into predominantly unlisted businesses. And so that's why we say it is transformational in nature. That obviously requires specialized skills and experience in terms of adding value to those transactions so that the private equity fund manager can buy a specific company for 100 and sell it in 3 or 4 or 5 years' time for 5 or 6 times that amount of cash. Reasons why corporates would seek private equity financing, there are a variety of reasons listed there, from increasing working capital to taking out a specific shareholder, the introduction of BEE, financing M&A activity, and the likes. The global playing field for private equity, South Africa is a small part of that pie, with just on 1% of the total amount of investments made. It's obviously a very competitive environment where South African private equity fund managers compete with fund managers around the world for access to a scarce commodity, that being capital, from institutional investors around the world. Most of the activity that takes place in our industry is investments by our private equity fund managers or members of SAFCA into businesses that are in that expansion and development stage. So that's where economic growth will take place. If you look at BEE investment activity, I mentioned up front that our industry has some 97.6 billion rands worth of funds under management. Some 77% of that amount has some type of BEE credential, where the private equity fund manager has some type of BEE scoring when they make an investment into a portfolio company that translates to ownership in the hands of black individuals. In 2003, that proportion was less than 35%. The graph that you see in front of you shows the equity portion of deals done by our industry into those three categories of BEE types of businesses, where some 4.8 billion rand was invested during 2010, and that would be the equity portion only of those transactions. As I mentioned up front, South Africa is a small part of the global pie in relation to the investment activity. If you look at the funds that have been raised over the last couple of years from a South African point of view, you'll see that there's a large support base from South Africa, where development finance institutions, pension funds, banks, insurance companies, and the like are providing funding to private equity fund managers. So they're investing into the funds that then go and invest into unlisted businesses. But you'll see that 60% of our capital under management comes from foreign sources. And as I mentioned, private equity is a 10-year game. So this is long-term foreign direct investment, where those investors are making a commitment to that specific fund for a 10-year period. Moving on then to the economic impact, we did a survey along with the DBSA from 2006 to 2009, where we surveyed 329 South African private equity portfolio companies that our members had invested into. And to show some of that economic value add, the employment growth rate across that set of companies was 9% per annum, compared to JSE businesses that grow at 4%, and the Stats SA number across all businesses in South Africa of only 1%. The South African private equity industry, through its portfolio companies, employs on just 5% of South Africa's formal workforce, around about 427,000 jobs. The average turnover, pre-tax profit, and average R&D expenditure of that portfolio of companies outperforms the JSE businesses on all scores. We also asked the respondents to that survey what was the positive contributions made to their businesses by the private equity fund manager. Overwhelmingly allowed the business to grow faster, obviously the introduction of BEE, and I'll make some more comments about that in a few minutes' time, and then importantly, at least at the bottom end of the scale in terms of the types of transaction, being responsible for the existence or survival of that specific business. If you look at where efficiencies and other parts of businesses' performance have increased post the investment by private equity fund managers, you'll see efficiencies increased, profits increased, on which taxes are paid on those profits, obviously investment expenditure and capital expenditure or CapEx, and the introduction of BEE. I mentioned up front that private equity is transformational in nature and involves specialized skill sets. We asked those respondents what was the main contribution or what was the main reason in relation to sourcing finance from private equity. Not surprising to us was the contribution beyond financial, where the private equity fund manager plays an important role and a pivotal role in growing those businesses that they invest into. So that gives you a real quick snapshot as to where private equity is in relation to South African businesses and sources of funding. I'll hand over to Mark.
Mr. Chairman, honourable members, I'm sure you're tired of hearing about Section 45, but I believe that private equity needs a fair hearing. It's been bandied about as one of the bad guys, and I'd like to show you why it isn't. The first slide deals with the typical deal structure. We've been shown lots of pictures already, so I won't dwell on it. The top part just shows that the seller sells shares, and the Bidco, which is owned by the private equity investors, uses a bridge loan to buy those shares. The bottom half of the slide shows how the newco borrows a bank loan and buys the assets of the target, and the money finds its way up to Bidco and the bridge is repaid. What are the reasons for debt pushdown? It makes the acquisition more feasible for the investors. One of the first lessons in management accounting that you learn is that when an investor makes a lot more money if they gear up their investment. And as we heard yesterday and today, in most other countries, you get an interest deduction if you buy shares in a company. South Africa, you don't. It optimizes the debt security by giving the lenders direct access to assets and cash. The debt is advanced to a newly formed company. That's quite important to the lenders. You can uplift the market values of the assets and present a solvent balance sheet to all your stakeholders. And the legal structures can be simplified because you can liquidate, you can squash a multitude of companies into one. And as we heard yesterday, SARS and National Treasury have known about the structuring from the start. They've shown refreshing pragmatism in this regard. They know that it addresses a structural problem in our South African tax system. It gives us parity with the rest of the world, so we can compete for foreign money. So So what has spooked National Treasury? They talk about excessive debt from lenders who are foreign and tax exempt. In order to understand the extent of their concern, I think we need to have a look at what has happened over the last 5 years. This next slide shows the amounts invested by private equity funds over 10 years. The bottom part of each bar is new investments, and the top part is follow-on investments. So that's for expansion post-acquisition. You can see from 2001 to, say, 2006, there's a gradual incline. And then what stands out is 2007 and 2008. This is the money invested by the private equity funds into portfolio companies in South Africa. And you can see 2007, there was a big jump in activity, in new investments. But since 2007, deal flow has normalized. So let's look at what drove the deal flow in 2007 and 2008. The period ended about mid-2008. The landscape, there was lots of positive sentiment in the world, and growth forecasts were good. The world was flooded with liquidity and cheap debt, and that was as a result of the subprime structuring. The foreign bond markets were very active, and a handful of private equity deals in South Africa were funded by means of foreign bonds. I think there were about 5 of them. Local banks were lending on more generous terms, and a few debt packages were tranched. What this means is that you tell some of your lenders to stand back in the queue for repayment. Therefore, they take a lot more risk, and the interest rates are a lot higher. And in those days, you could get up to 70% gearing in a company. If we look what the position is now, we've seen no new foreign bond issues for private equity transactions, so there's no foreign debt. The mezzanine funding for the big deals has dried up. That's mezzanine funding is the back-ranked debt. That's a lot more risk and a lot higher interest rates. The local banks have remained very cautious in providing debt, and today you can only get up to about 50% gearing for a company. The interest rates from the South African banks are in the range of JIBOR plus 2 to 4%. Therefore, the interest rates are not excessive. This next slide shows a typical capital structure, say, in 2007, compared to what it looks like today. The bottom part shows the third-party bank debt. And if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see up to 70% of third-party bank debt. Then the next part was the mezzanine portion, that red part on the left. It was a very small portion of the debt package. National Treasury seemed to think that it was a very big portion of the debt package, but it's not. It wasn't. And you can also see that currently we're not seeing mezzanine debt instruments. On the left-hand side, some deals, as I said, were foreign bonds. The top two parts of each graph are the share capital, being the top bit, and shareholder loans. In terms of the Tax Act, SARS practice, you can only introduce shareholder funding in the ratio of 3-1. So 3 parts of shareholder loan, 1 part of share capital. Also, the Reserve Bank limits the interest rates that's charged on those shareholder loans. limits it to prime. So the interest rates are not excessive on those shareholder loans. And there's also withholding tax and interest from 2013. So I come back to the question, what has spooked National Treasury and SARS? They probably had a good look at some of the deals that were done in 2007. And they're concerned at the amount of the foreign debt, so that left side of the slide. But 2007 was a global anomaly. It was burned by the perfect storm that was debt, subprime structuring. And I don't think I'll see those dynamics in my lifetime again. There's no longer a dire threat to the tax base in new deals. The heavy-handed measure of suspending Section 45 is therefore not warranted. 18 months would have a severe impact on the industry. I mean, the deal lead times are up to 2 years long, where there's sensitive negotiations going on with target companies, and to suspend activity for 18 months will have a severe impact. SAFCA is more than happy to meet with National Treasury offline and to discuss this further. I think that's all we want to say on Section 45. The other issue we also wanted to deal with was the 10-year change to preference shares. In some target companies in South Africa, you can't actually use debt. There are very few cases, but examples are regulated industries such as long-term life assurance. You can't put debt on the balance sheets. There could be targets in the mining sector where it's too sensitive to transfer the mining rights because it's just too difficult to get approvals. And so in these instances, what normally happens is preference shares are issued, and it's the South African banks that subscribe for these preference shares. So there's no loss to the fiscus. 10 years will eliminate this sort of funding, this source of funding, and there are quite a few instruments in place already. And you know, the banks have come to live with 3 years, but grudgingly have come to live with three years. I don't think they're going to live with 10 years. So I think it's going to do a lot of damage. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the next presenter here? Thank you. Comar Mensa. Platon's Rus.
Yeah, I think we might see this on
the... I've already seen that.
Okay.
There we are. Put that on. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, to introduce ourselves to you and to committee members. We have come here to represent the Banking Association South Africa, and thank you for the opportunity to present to the committee, standing committee. Mr. Chairman, I think you will have heard a lot of technical discussion in the last couple of days, including before that from National Treasury as well. What we would like to say at the outset is that we completely accept that it's the role of National Treasury and SARS to constantly examine transactions that are underway to make sure that there are no unexpected major leakages in the tax system that reduce the South African tax base. So we believe this is a completely legitimate function, and that SARS and National Treasury have to be vigilant all the time to monitor changing circumstances. So we can understand that if they have identified situations that cause grave concern, that they should want to take action. We believe, though, that this action as planned probably significantly overstates what is needed. And we'd like to make some suggestions as alternatives in a short while. But if at the outset, if you don't mind this being a, or me being a bit of a lecturer, I'll try not to come across in that way. But I think it's quite important to understand a very basic principle of what leakage involves to a tax system. Leakage occurs when there's an unanticipated deduction that diminishes the tax base, or an unanticipated exemption of some sort of income that also diminishes the tax base with no reciprocal change on the other side. So in other words, where, for example, there are massive interest deductions coming about through transactions, and the lenders, the recipients of the income on the other side, are themselves within the tax base, there's no leakage as far as the tax base is concerned. There's a deduction amongst one group of taxpayers, and there's an inclusion of income in a group of other South African taxpayers. Where leakage would occur in the case of financing transactions is if the lenders were outside the tax system, and that could occur in two broad ways. The one would be that the lenders may be tax-exempt entities within South Africa, or alternatively, they may be non-South African entities who do not have a tax presence in South Africa. So that, when that occurs, there is leakage as far as the South African tax system is concerned. But the question is whether such lending is a good or bad thing, and secondly, if there's some sort of measure to claw back something into the South African tax base, notwithstanding the fact that inherently that sort of lending results in leakage. Now, it is completely legitimate for National Treasury to examine those two types of lending and to decide what measures need to be put in place to alleviate the situation. At the same time, though, the draft tax legislation brings in another group of concerns which are closely related to the concerns relating to leakage on debt finance. And that is the concern about the law or the substance behind financing transactions as to whether the financing transactions inherently involve debt or equity. And Treasury have mentioned quite correctly that many of the instruments used are of a hybrid nature. They have characteristics of debt and of equity. And Treasury has expressed the wish to more clearly define where the cutoff point should be between the two. I think that, again, is also a perfectly legitimate aim. The point we're trying to make, though, that is that the use of hybrid equity doesn't inherently result in tax leakage to the system, just as the use of debt doesn't result in leakage when both parties are South African taxpayers. In the case of hybrid instruments, it goes even further, and one can make the statement that there's no leakage to the South African tax system, even if the lender is a non-South African taxpayer. The reason is that if financing is given in the form of equity, the financing is serviced through the payment of a dividend. There's no tax deduction for a dividend, and the fact that, therefore, the receipt of the dividend in the hands of the lender is not taxable, either because there is an inherent exemption, or because the lender is non-South African, is not relevant, because there is no deduction to the borrower in the first place. So there's no leakage. It's exactly the same as if in an interest-bearing debt there'd been a deduction for the interest and the other party is taxable on receiving the interest. By the same token, pref share financing or hybrid equity financing means there's no deduction to the borrower and no taxation in the hands of the lender. It's the same situation. In both cases, no leakage. In most advanced economies, that's the rule that they apply, and what it results in is equilibrium. Now, very many of the structures that National Treasury is concerned about are structures which have been devised to re-establish equilibrium, not to result in a diminution of the tax base. And let me give an example of the imbalance that would result if there wasn't appropriate structuring to re-establish the balance. It's been mentioned by the previous speaker, and I'm sure by many others before, that in South Africa, business-to-business borrowing, which is used to finance the purchase of equity, results in non-deductible interest, even though it's purely business-related. That relates to old established principles in South African tax law, but which are not matched in most other economies. So you have a situation that there is a purchase of equity purely in the business environment. I'm not talking of investment environments. And the interest incurred is not deductible, but the interest received by the South African bank that finances it is taxable. So there is an imbalance. There is an arbitrage, to use the term, in favor of SARS. So it's not a balanced situation. It's an imbalance. And what happens in those circumstances is that these transactions are financed through preference share financing, which means that equilibrium is reestablished. There's no tax deduction for preference share dividends, and there's no taxation of the dividends received. So what is happening is that at the moment, the South African tax system encourages a negative arbitrage in favor of the fiscus. And most structures that I've ever seen simply seem to are aimed at re-establishing the equilibrium, not at getting a tax advantage, but eliminating a disadvantage. Now, there are circumstances where this pendulum can swing completely the other way and establish a tax disadvantage to SARS, and those I've mentioned already. Where a transaction is financed through interest-bearing debt, whether or not Section 45 is used, and it's done in such a way that there is a tax deduction, but the recipient is a tax-exempt entity or is a non-South African entity. And I think it's quite legitimate for SARS to seek to address that, because that's creating an imbalance against the fiscus and against any South African taxpayer. But the measures that are needed to re-establish equilibrium should not be viewed as inherently problematic. Now, I'm mentioning these concepts, and so forgive me for this sort of semi-lecture, because they underlie most of the the proposed changes that are creating such amount of heat at the moment. The definition of what is debt and what is equity, the 10-year rule being proposed for preference shares, all those things result from a need that Treasury sees in defining the difference between debt and equity, but the definition is being pushed over into such a harsh way, pushed over to such an extreme, that it will be almost impossible to use preference share financing in the future for any significant transaction. And that's for the simple reason that banks look after your money and my money. They've got to manage the risk involved. If they are putting in equity, they cannot put equity in for a 10-year period in most cases. It's just not feasible. It's too much risk. It's the bank's money, but more importantly, it's your money that's been placed at risk. And the risk is unacceptable if the period is that long. Essentially, the preference share market will dry up overnight, and a major source of financing in South Africa will disappear. You might say, well, why don't these transactions be financed using debt then? The answer is quite simple. If you use debt to finance an equity transaction, there's no tax deduction for it. That makes it extremely expensive. So I keep on circling around to the same issue again. There's an imbalance in the South African tax system that needs to be addressed. And if it's addressed, most of the transactions that SARS is concerned about will disappear. There will no longer be transactions that result in a negative effect on the tax base, providing that the attention that Treasury gives is targeted to the areas of concern, and that is where debt is used, as I've said three times now, and the other party is for some reason not in the South African tax base. We think it's completely legitimate that Treasury should look at what they should do to remedy that situation, and we believe that does not require an 18-month moratorium on transactions. We don't believe it requires a problematic redefinition of what preference shares are. Those things don't really address the issue. What will address the issue is targeted measures, surgical measures, rather than such a broad-based approach, which will significantly, in our view, diminish financing in the South African economy in the next 18 months, and potentially thereafter, because of the definition of preference shares, in the long term as well. The third surgical measure that I believe legitimately should be looked at is in the Section 45 provisions as they now stand, Treasury is concerned that they are being used to finance takeovers rather than intra-group reorganizations. Again, we believe that's a legitimate concern. They should be entitled to re-examine that provision, but I don't see it would require 18 months to draw up something that addresses that concern of theirs. I think that concern could be addressed quite easily in a much shorter period, and as a consequence, Mr. Chairman, what we would like to propose is that given that we understand where Treasury are coming from, but given that we also believe that their approach is far too broad-ranging, we would suggest that the moratorium, if it is to be there at all, should be no longer than 3 months, and that attention should then be given during that moratorium period of a surgical approach to the areas of concern that I have mentioned and which I think are completely valid. I think it's wrong to simply condemn the Treasury proposals
on the basis of them being potentially having a dramatic effect. That isn't the issue. As I said at the outset, it's their job to protect the South African tax base. But the current proposals are far too wide-ranging. They're far too... The moratorium period is far too long and would create, I believe, significant problems in long-term financing in the economy. And we believe that this more concise, shorter period of surgical attention to the problem areas would be successful in eliminating most, if not all, of the problem areas that National Treasury is concerned about. Mr. Chairman, there are a number of other areas that cause concern to the banking sector in the proposals. Many of these are fairly technical, and we will be taking advantage of the invitation to lodge more detailed proposals or comments, shall I say, by the 5th of July, when they've been requested. Sorry, that's the deadline date for them. But I don't think it's necessary to go into detail on the, relating to those before this committee. We believe that the points that we've made are the important ones in terms of the big picture. The other areas that we'll deal with are more technical in nature. I'm sure there'll be a whole variety of different suggestions from a whole range of parties, and we'll be very happy to engage with National Treasury and with SARS on those in the weeks to come. But the big picture, as far as this committee is concerned, I believe Parliament and the Parliamentary Committee should be dealing with the big picture, and so we have confined our suggestions, and we believe, we hope, in a constructive way, to those brief, sorry, to those short suggestions. And to repeat again, moratorium, we suggest 3 months, and surgical approach to the real issues. And thirdly, that the imbalance that is inherent in the South African tax system, which is biased against interest used to buy equity, be removed. And we believe that those 3 measures would substantially simplify the whole approach and create significantly less disruption than the current draft proposals are potentially likely to create. Mr. Chairman, we've been fairly short and sweet. We're very happy to take any questions from the floor. Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman, to interrupt myself just briefly. Just a reminder to committee members that there are many types of restructuring that are relate simply to businesses trying to achieve more efficient structures, or which may relate to corporate actions such as takeovers, but there are others that are imposed by regulators. And we all know that the financial services sector in the last few years has been greatly under scrutiny by regulators. There is restructuring which is regulator-driven taking place in the banking sector and, more importantly, in the insurance sector. And that restructuring will have to come to ground and halt if this moratorium of 18 months applies. Now, most of this restructuring was expected to have been put in place during the course of the next 18 months. And all of that will have to grind to a halt while this moratorium continues, which is one further reason why we strongly suggest that if it is to take place at all, that it be restricted to a maximum of 3 months. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Indeed, you were short. I'm not sure about sweetness. But you are short, and I think direct to the point. And that's what you expect from representatives of the bank. You know, they are very direct in terms of what they want to say.
Honorable members, I guess we have received all the presentation. It is our opportunity to engage. But before that, I just, for the last presenters, on page one of your document, paragraph number four, where you speak of an overriding principle. I assume I'm speaking to the Banking Association. Yeah. You see, small paragraph there. An overriding principle overlooked and not properly addressed in the Tax Loss Amendment Bill is that any direct tax on dividends, strictly speaking, amounts to double tax on profits with no corresponding deduction for the company payer. Can you explain that a bit?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. There are a number of different tax systems that exist worldwide, but with one exception, and that is a very big exception, that is of the U.S., with one exception, the systems all seek to prevent the economic double taxation of corporate earnings. So the idea is that they are taxed once and then distributed. And amongst other things, there are advanced corporation tax systems and so on. What South Africa operates is what is called the classic system. And that is one that says that the company is taxed at the company tax rate, and then the after-tax profits of the company may then be distributed as a dividend, which is then not taxed in the hands of the recipient. In other words, all dividends flowing from equity are not can be received by the recipient without the recipient being taxed, but also the company gets no tax deduction for paying the dividend. So that is part of the point I made earlier about neutrality. When a dividend is paid, it has no positive or negative effect on the fiscus. It deals with after-tax profits, no deduction on one hand, no taxation on the other. The company has been taxed, and that is the slice of tax that is paid to the fiscus. Now, anything which seeks to modify that negatively results in economic double taxation of the company earnings. So, for example, as we know, as I said, the dividend is never tax deductible. So if there are circumstances where a dividend is made to be taxable in the hands of the recipient, which can occur under the preference share proposals, you have an imbalance because there's no deduction for the dividend paid, but the dividend received is taxable as some sort of deemed interest. And that's where you have the double taxation that occurs. That dividend has to be financed by the payer out of after-tax income. And if you're then taxing the recipient, it results in double tax. In contrast with interest, so when a company pays interest to, let's say, a bank, the company can take the tax deduction, but the bank is taxed on the interest. So that also establishes an equilibrium. And there's no double tax involved, the deduction on the one hand and taxation on the other hand. The double tax comes when there's no deduction for the dividend, but the recipient is taxed. And that is a significant imbalance that is created. And hence our concerns that we should have an equilibrium system in the country. Now, I've mentioned that interest is usually deductible on the one hand and taxed on the other hand in the hands of the recipient. But when interest finances the purchase of equity, the interest is not deductible, even though the recipient may be taxed. So it's the other method of imbalance in the system. It's the other example of imbalance in the system, and that's the one we believe that if it's eliminated, most of these complex structuring arrangements that so concern National Treasury will disappear.
Yeah, I think as we or as you interact further with National Treasury, probably on the workshop site, these are some of the issues that will be clarified from where I'm sitting. Further engagements will happen at that level. But this is now the opportunity for honorable members to ask questions. I must say, the presenters, almost all of the presentation that we have received, I have a sense that we are also missing an opportunity to talk about the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. We have actually reduced this amendment bill to Section 45. That's my sense. The rest of the amendments, I don't think we're paying attention to them. Probably it is because of the gravity and the nature of what Section 45 impact is all about out there. And obviously I think it is more about large and corporate transactions that are taking place in this particular sphere. We have also proposals in terms of this bill before us on turnover tax. Very little is said about it. I don't know, maybe it is because it is at the lower end of the transactions. And I haven't heard a voice coming for those or for that particular section of economic activists or players at that level. I hope as we move on, but that's for us as honorable members to look into that particular aspect. For me, it's something that I'm just observing. Honorable members, Honorable Speaker, I saw your hand, Honorable George, and who else? All right.
Thank you, Chairperson. My question is directed to Ravura. Based on the presentation, it appears that you're quite involved in the e-transaction and Chairperson, I was saying that based on the presentation by Bravura, it appears that you are quite involved in BE transactions and in putting together structures relating to Section 45. My question then is, will you be willing as Bravura to give details of all the structures that you have put together to this committee to further enhance our discussions on this matter? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. To all or any of the presenters who want to respond, it's often said that this county has a voice, gets a voice from big business and the tax practitioners, but nothing from individual taxpayers who struggle every day to make ends meet when they have to pay their tax and various other things. Now, my question is, how does the so-called suspension of Section 45 impact on those taxpayers who will bear the burden of higher personal income tax if our corporate tax base is steadily eroded? So in other words, this so-called suspension of 45, what impact, if any, does it have on individual taxpayers? And then to the Banking Association, you mentioned the imbalance in the tax system. And in your submission, you made various recommendations to the Treasury. And then right at the end, on page number 8, you're going to say, in the event that National Treasury does not agree with any of the recommendations above, then we urge that National Treasury reconsiders allowing a deduction for interest on debt incurred to acquire shares. Now, are you actually asking National Treasury to consider this, or are you saying they should only consider it in the event that they don't actually take up any of your recommendations above? I'd like to know what the position of the Banking Association is actually on that. Thank you, Chair.
Those are the two questions from the side of committee members. Can you respond?
Thank you. Perhaps just on the question regarding our willingness to meet with National Treasury to discuss BE transactions, I just want to state that in 2008, we actually did have a session also with National Treasury where we actually took them through all the methods in terms of which BE transactions are typically structured and also the commercial reasons why they are structured on that basis. And we did the same with the Department of Trade and Industry. And we would be very much willing to do that again. And in fact, we did have a discussion last night with National Treasury and accepted such an invitation as well.
Yeah? Yes, sir?
Mr. Chairman and honourable members, firstly, as to the effects of the erosion of the corporate tax base, the evidence that I've seen in recent years has been that the corporate tax base has been increasing quite significantly, but I have stated at the outset that I'll completely accept that National Treasury has to keep safeguarding that tax base, and if there's any evidence of significant erosion, they should be acting. So I don't think it should be a question of allowing it and then resulting in an increased burden on ordinary taxpayers. I think they should be reacting in such a way that there will not be a negative effect on individual taxpayers. The point that we're making is that those reactions should be more surgical and not as broad-based as planned, because the broad base of the current proposals go far beyond what is surgically needed to protect the tax base and potentially will affect economic activity negatively, which will then result in a decrease in corporate activity, which will result in a decrease in the corporate tax base, which will have a negative effect on individual taxpayers. So we completely accept that corporates must play their part as contributors to the fiscus, and that Treasury should be safeguarding that contribution. And never should any kind of major leakage occur that has a negative effect on individual taxpayers. We are aware in this country we have a significant imbalance in wealth, and the last thing you actually want is increased tax burdens on individuals as a result of negative corporate activity. Mr. Chairman, on the second part of that question, I think you made a very good point. I think the way we phrased it there is probably a little, it could have been phrased better. We believe that the issue of the imbalance in the tax system is an overriding one and should be attended to in any event. I think this particular comment started off on the basis of saying, well, if there are to be circumstances where dividends are made to be taxable, then a deduction should be allowed. In other words, if nothing is accepted of all our detailed submissions and still preference share dividends will be made taxable in certain circumstances, there should be balance restored by allowing a deduction in those circumstances. But I'm going to step further by saying that balance should be restored to the system as a whole at the outset, notwithstanding any of these proposals. It's the fundamental imbalance that creates so many of the problematic transactions that concerns National Treasury. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you very much. Honorable Goranov. Thank you. I think honorable members and our visitors and presenters, we have come to the end of our public hearing process today. And I think we have received very, very informative submissions from your good selves, those who came yesterday and yourselves today. I did outline the process in terms of how this bill is going to be processed, which I believe you have. What will be of our interest as a committee? It will be your final submissions to the National Treasury, so that we can also be given an opportunity to go through those submissions at our own time as a committee and marry your submissions with the report pack report that National Treasury is going to come back and share with the honorable members in this committee. Definitely, we are going to apply our minds as a committee. This is a very, very important piece of legislation, and I think BUSA captured it very well in terms of its aims and objectives. Of course, within those aims and objectives, you realize that this amendment is also about trying to achieve that which is the most devastating effect to the lives of our ordinary people: employment creation and growth, sustainable growth of our economy, and obviously increasing the ability of the fiscals to can deal with a number of issues that are pertinent to citizens of this country. With those few words, I would really like to take this opportunity to thank you for making time. We know that it was never enough and time will never be adequate for you to make presentations, but we know we've been able to perform excellently as South Africans in the area of managing our resources and bringing predictability and certainty into our systems. And that is why, in terms of budget transparency, South Africa is rated number one today in the world. This is part of that process. We should never underestimate, you know, the efforts and our own contribution in building a society that is admired by many, and I think we are on our way to achieve that objective. Thank you very much. Meeting stands adjourned until further notice.
Okay, no, no, no.